Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs, occur with more frequency than we are aware, and the lasting effects can be devastating. TBIs not only occur from accidents, but also from medical conditions like seizures or stroke. TBIs bring hundreds of Alaskans to our medical centers each year. However, not every traumatic brain injury is apparent. Thus, many go undiagnosed and don't get the services and treatments needed to heal. Let's shed a light on traumatic brain injury and the multidisciplinary treatment team required for the best outcomes. Joining us today is Dr. Katie Jakes, Doctor of Physical Therapy and Clinical Director of South Central Foundation Therapy Services and Alaska Native Medical Center Liaison on the Brain Injury Council of Alaska. Dr. Adam Grove, Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine and Private Practice in Anchorage, focused on brain-related issues to include brain injury, autism, ADHD, and age-related cognitive decline. Also joining us is Dr. Dan Hartman, primary care physician and service line medical director at South Central Foundation, involved in the development of services for persons with traumatic brain injury in Alaska. Dr. Jakes, Dr. Hartman, and Dr. Grove, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having us today. Nice to meet you.
You can also join our conversation. Have you experienced a traumatic brain injury? Are you supporting a loved one following a head injury? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Thank you again for being with us today and for the role you play in caring for those with brain-related conditions. We certainly have a lot to cover regarding traumatic and acquired brain injuries, but I'd love to learn a bit more about each of you and the role that you play. So let's start with Dr. Jakes. As Clinical Director of Therapy Services for South Central Foundation, you're working currently on furthering services for patients with traumatic and acquired brain injury. What led to your interest in TBI-related care?
Well, when I first started as a professional physical therapist at South Shore Hospital in Boston, my first role was actually starting up a concussion program with a PM&R doctor. So I kind of feel full circle that I get to work with at Alaska Native Medical Center in partnership with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Injury Prevention Group and Epidemiology to help implement some programs and kind of do a gap analysis to see what TBI care can look like for the state of Alaska.
Okay, you mentioned PM&R, so that's physical medicine and rehabilitation.
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. And how do you see the medical inpatient facilities and outpatient practices becoming more adaptable for patients with traumatic brain injury?
For our state, I think it's a lot of education, a lot of partnership with our community, and then being able to kind of, we have a lot of resources here in Alaska, knowing how to align them and work together and communicate to be able to serve the population.
Excellent, excellent. And I want to hear more about traumatic brain injury and what that is. So let's go with Dr. Hartman. And you are working as service line director at South Central Foundation. But you worked more than a decade in Bethel, which I find very interesting. How did your work there prepare you for your current role as medical director and specifically your services to those with brain injury?
Oh, well, that's a big question. the work in Bethel at Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation was work similar to anywhere else in any major hospital or emergency department trauma center. Of course, there's, injuries happen all the time to any of us without warning. The experience that I had in remote or village and more distant areas in the state actually was very different in some ways, very, very much more different than most urban United States trauma care, emergency department care, in particular because most of the folks that are injured are actually injured not in Bethel, but maybe in the village. And their principal immediate care is by health aides and by air transport, either to the hub, whether it's Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, Kodiak, and then transfer to Anchorage subsequently. So there's a lot of distance and geography that gets involved in the care, a lot of decision-making and logistics that gets involved in the care, including a lot of flight medicine.
That was really interesting to hear about all of the flights that are taken. So, of course, not just for traumatic brain injury, but with any injury or medical condition that happens. About how many medevac flights per day are we seeing around Alaska, or I guess specifically to Alaska Native Medical Center?
I actually don't have that number. All day?
All day.
And through the night. The state is one of the, our state is one of the most busy places in terms of flight medicine, and not just between the villages and the hubs and Anchorage, but also between Anchorage, Juneau, and Seattle. There's several flight medicine services that contract, and it's just a continuous launching.
Continuous work.
Continuous care 24/7. It's an extraordinary thing in our state that many people don't know a lot about because it's the landings are at Merrill Field, for example, here in Anchorage, and the transfer is relatively quiet because people are kind of stable and there aren't lights on ambulances, for example.
Okay. They've been stabilized out in the field, I guess, or out in their villages before they've been transported.
Correct. There's quite a lot of skill that the health aides are able to bring to this issue. They're true heroes. Honestly, they save lives every day in every way, shape, and form. The stabilization by them is not conclusive. For example, we don't have conclusive intubation or conclusive airway stabilization, but the initial stabilization is exemplary. All of our hubs have flight paramedics that have intubation ability and all the skills to put in IV lines, for example, run pressors, which help blood pressure support. Mm-hmm. And the paramedics can do quite a lot in a village clinic to stabilize and even with a conclusive airway potentially before transfer to Bethel. It's common that airway stabilization is necessary before you get a person into the confines of a small aircraft.
Okay, well, let's meet Dr. Grove. So we've all compared learning difficult subject matters to the difficulty of rocket science, but you actually have a background in aerospace engineering and served for 13 years of military intelligence prior to studying naturopathic medicine. So what led to your interest in naturopathic medicine and ultimately the treatment of brain injuries?
Well, yes, as you can tell, I've wandered all over the place, right? So I think really growing up in rural areas in the Southwest, lived in the Navajo Reservation when I was a little kid, and there was just not a lot of medicine, right? I didn't go to doctors, and so there were other ways my parents dealt with medical things, and so I learned how to live outside that standard medical community. And so after when I was in the military and seen Doctors Without Borders doing amazing things around the world, I said, that's what I want to do. I want to help people in that way. And so that's what got me into medicine, and I really wanted to practice a more holistic approach because I realized there's so much beyond what happens in the exam room or this in a prescription. And also, I had some TBIs. The biggest one occurred right after I started medical school. So that kind of led me down that path, and particularly big TBI in Seattle, that traumatic brain injury, was never diagnosed at the time. And I went through all sorts of crazy stuff, including medical school. But it was never diagnosed. I self-diagnosed probably 5 years after the fact. And so that got me thinking that probably there are a lot of other people in my same situation. And so if I can figure out how to fix myself, I can figure out how to help other people get better. So that's what led me to this, and I've been doing this for 20 years now.
Oh. Well, can you tell us what is a brain injury? What's traumatic brain injury?
I think, you know, so the easiest way to think about brain injury is that something happens to your brain that changes the way it works. Right. And our brain does so much that an injury to it can have incredible consequences. I think, like Dan described at one point, it's a consequential injury. And we talk mostly about differentiating between a traumatic brain injury and acquired brain injury. And I think that that definition is just somewhat artificial. And the way it breaks out is an acquired brain injury is one that occurs as a result of a stroke or a near drowning or a brain tumor removal, something like that. Whereas a traumatic brain injury happens because of a shock or a jolt, you know, a bullet through the head, you know, that type of thing. But I would argue, as my patients would probably agree, every single one of those is traumatic, right? So it's, but it's somewhat an artificial definition. And if you actually, like, if you get on Google and Google brain injury, you will almost always find information about traumatic brain injury and very little about acquired. We don't think about strokes or near drownings leading to brain injuries, but there's far more of those than there are traumatic brain injuries. But the problem is that those are usually diagnosed. The things like Dan was talking about that require a medevac, those are usually brain injuries that have been identified and people are seeking treatment. But the vast majority of traumatic brain injuries, up to 75%, are never reported, never diagnosed. And that's my concern because they're still consequential injuries, but they're not getting the attention that these other injuries are getting.
Well, you mentioned that you experienced a traumatic brain injury during medical school. What are some of the symptoms that you noticed or that you'd seen in other patients and thought that that you had similar symptoms?
The first symptoms that I experienced, and they're similar for many people, and studies kind of indicate this, they're physical symptoms, right? So I had extreme headaches, neck pain. I was sensitive to light, sensitive to sound, and there were some cognition issues too, memory, word finding, those types of things. But there's a whole sequence of other things that happen over time that happen after brain injury, and the vast majority of people experience those physical symptoms and they resolve, you know, within 6 weeks or so, right? But up to 50 to 60% of people in studies experience what they call post-concussive syndrome, and that's where these symptoms persist, and this is where cognitive issues start to predominate, maybe poor decision-making, depressed mood, anxiety, and a number of things that look like a lot of other things, and those are the persistent ones, and those are the worrisome ones.
So if your symptoms resolve in 5 to 6 weeks, is it still considered a traumatic brain injury?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's still a diagnosis, just like having a broken leg. You just happen to recover from it. You don't have a perpetual limp.
Okay. So I agree with you that it sounds like all brain injuries would be traumatic, but I understand how they're, you know, differentiating it between something acquired from a medical situation or and then something acquired from an accident. I guess they could all actually be acquired and traumatic. Well, Dr. Hartman, you were talking about those in outlying villages and the difficulties of transport. Does the initial treatment of a traumatic brain injury to someone outside of a large city, outside of Anchorage, differ from what it would be in Anchorage if there's no issue with airway?
Essentially, no. If airway control is assured and in a moderate to severe injury, blood pressure matters. So assuming airway control or blood pressure stability, the care would essentially be the same in an outlying village or community or here in town.
And then I imagine the diagnosis of a traumatic brain injury following an accident would be known that this is something that they are going to be looking for versus those that come from medical conditions like Dr. Grove was talking about tumors or near drowning. Are they able to diagnose these things in the villages as well or in other cities outside of Anchorage or larger medical communities?
Excuse me. Yes. but Adam's point is a very good one, that especially mild traumatic brain injury or moderate injury that may have been from another source or remote source, or a severe injury that may have been from a remote source, may commonly go underdiagnosed or undiagnosed. Brain injury in childhood, for example, brain injury during a medical event or near drowning, it's underappreciated in the medical community how significant long-term behavior challenges can be consequent to a brain injury. One of our main efforts here in town and in the state is to raise awareness for that in the medical community, not only improve treatment and collaboration, but also so that providers understand that it is an issue.
Well, that's a good segue to Dr. Jakes, and I'd like to learn more about the goal of the Brain Injury Council of Alaska.
Yeah, so we recently just changed our name to the Brain Injury Council of Alaska. So other people may be familiar with it as the Traumatic and Acquired Brain Injury Council of Alaska. I think just within the last month we changed our name. But the overall goal is to increase awareness of TBI and to discover as a state and work in collaboration with other states to figure out what a good continuum of care is at all levels to be able to treat and identify traumatic and acquired brain injuries. I've only been on the council for just about a year now. Dr. Grove has more experience over time, so if I misspeak to anything, Dr. Grove, please don't be shy to kind of hop in. But at least since June 2020, the council moved to the UAA Centers for Human and Disease Human Development. So they have an MOA with the senior, which is a memorandum of agreement with the Senior and Disability Services to lead the TBI State Partnership Program federal grant. We did just finalize a new strategic plan. So with that involves data collecting, knowing what data to collect, analyzing it, and then collaborating with statewide agencies. There's training, so we're looking for peer support. There's resource facilitators around the state, and then they coordinate. We're looking to, in the future, coordinate a series of echoes to complement what Dan was just saying about increasing awareness within the state, not only within the medical community, but the outlying community as well.
Did you say echoes?
Yeah. I actually don't know what ECHO stands for.
ECHOs are a pioneer of video conferencing in the medical community, where we basically improve awareness and provider support for particular medical challenges. So you can do an ECHO in liver disease, you can do an ECHO in palliative care, you can do an ECHO in brain injury.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
And then just collaborating with other national work groups and identifying for some assessment tools to be able to identify people who have had TBI or have new TBIs.
So increasing awareness for TBIs or traumatic brain injury and education. So when you're talking education, who is the main focus of those that you're educating? Or are you educating providers? Are you educating on prevention? Are you who's being educated?
It's going to be a little bit of all of it, right? So as a group, depending on who that subject matter expert or person that's passionate for that work, we'll look to educate each other. So I guess an example of that are there's resources for family, for family members and people who have traumatic brain injury. And that is what is also lovely about the Brain Injury Council of Alaska are there are the members are not only medical professionals, but people from all around the state, different state agencies, as well as people who have experienced TBI. So together between the people that experience it and the people that want to help treat it, we're hoping to kind of fill the gaps across our state to be able to provide these services for everyone that will meet the needs of each of the groups. The TABI advice or the Brain Injury Council of Alaska does have a family and survivor of TABI group. It's called Survivor and Family Empowerment Committee, so the SAFE Committee, and that is open to the public, and that occurs the second Tuesday from 11 to 11:30 Alaska time that people that have experienced a traumatic brain injury or the family members of or caregivers can jump into this Zoom meeting and meet other people who are experiencing the same difficulties that they are.
Like that, can they learn more about treatment options as well?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of different topics that occur at those meetings, and there's work done by the Brain Injury Council that we're trying to figure out. The resource facilitators are a great resource to kind of figure out within the different regions what's helpful, but as well as Daniela DeLozer is helping run a project with the University of Oregon on a resource facilitator tool, which is like either an app or on a website where you can type in the symptom in your area and a zip code, and then it'll pull it up. So that work's being done now. So a lot of work is in action to be able to fill some of these gaps of information to share with people so that they have it at their fingertips.
Technology is really amazing, yeah. And the connections that we can form now are great. We have our first caller, so I would like to welcome Kristen from Anchor Point to Line 1. Hello, Kristen.
Hello. I'm wondering about football. Lately, we've been hearing in the news about professional football players suffering from brain injuries that are affecting them in later life, in fact, sometimes even paralyzing them. And I'm wondering, considering the love of football in this country, where they have little like peewee football teams going on, to high school football teams, to college football teams. What is the actions that can be done, especially in the young children, the school kids, to prevent brain injuries from taking place in such young ages? And I'll take it off the air.
Okay, thanks so much, Kristen. That's a great question. I am a football lover, so I like to hear these answers myself. Let's start. We have everyone who wants to say something. Let's start with Dr. Hartman.
Well, maybe, Jillian, you would be the expert here, too. We, over the last decade in Alaska and nationwide, have done a good job of working with schools, school systems and healthcare systems to establish baseline concussion data for all students. It's a mandated thing in contact sports, especially in high school. We have a whole return to play protocol that's established throughout the state where healthcare providers that are caring for children or teens that are involved in sports understand how to manage concussion. Coaches are very, and parents and volunteers and booster club folks are very much involved in the return to play protocol, and it's and how it's run, how it's established. This has all brought a great deal of awareness to concussion, and I love that the caller is bringing this up. It's just a mark of how our community understanding of the risks of brain injury with sport, our community understanding of those risks is really increasing. The numbers are interesting. I believe it's 10% of college football athletes will suffer a concussion, and 20% of high school football athletes. Other sports are also have risk, hockey, boxing. I don't want to point a finger at any one sport. I'm a fan of the game myself.
Yeah, Dr. Hartman, I had shared with him earlier that my father played professional football for 12 years, and so I've noticed or learned throughout the years, especially as he's been active with the NFL alumni, that there's been several of his former teammates and friends, whom I called uncles, you know, that had suffered traumatic brain injuries that went undiagnosed, and some of them, it led to mental health issues, others physical issues. So it's something that's, you know, very dear to me, and although football is, you know, an amazing sport. But, you know, I think there's risks in all of those contact sports, right? Dr. Grove, I think you wanted to add something.
Yes, I think this is a really great topic, and it's we spend a lot of time and attention on sports and sports-related injuries, but they're really a very small percentage of the overall burden of traumatic brain injury. But it gets a lot of attention, right, because there's a lot of money in sports. And a recent study by the Concussion Legacy Foundation, I think it was, showed that 60% of NFL football players that they've tested show signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is what happens to the brain after repeated injuries, and those brains look a lot like somebody with Alzheimer's. And so the important thing is that CTE, those chronic changes that happen to the brain occur after many, many brain injuries. If you've had two or three or four of bike crashes or something, that's not going to be an issue for you, right? So that's important before people start worrying about that. But I think the question about kids in sports is an excellent one. The Concussion Legacy Foundation just started a program, basically flag under 14, right? So you do not play contact football until you're above 14. And there's good reasons for that. If you go to their website, there's brochures and handouts on this. Because the way children's brains develop, they really don't have the neck strength and the ability to withstand those impacts until they're older. And we do have rules in this state. There's a state statute, 1430.142, that establishes sports-related concussions. But I think, I would like to think that this is being enacted across the state, but my experience is that it is not. It's been on the books, and for some time the school district here in Anchorage was doing impact testing, which was that baseline scoring, so they could tell if somebody got a concussion if they scored worse after that, so they could return to the play. But there are rules in place, and the Alaska School Activities Association, ASAA, maintains a website that has information on concussions. But I just checked this morning the link for health care provider education and the link for educator information for brain injury, they're broken. They go nowhere. And they show currently 97 providers in the state of Alaska that have identified themselves as being people who are trained to return people to concussion, to play, student athletes. So that's good that we've got those folks out there. And they're all the way from MDs, family practice people, to neurosurgeons, to chiropractors, physical therapists. So we've got a group of folks out there that can do this, but I don't think the emphasis is there as much as it should be on this, and I think that's something we can certainly work on as a state to make sure that is actually those rules are actually being implemented statewide.
Well, thank you, Dr. Grove. You brought up a call to action then to fix those links and to make sure that we're adhering to these guidelines, right? And then I like that you did bring up about the developing brain, because I didn't think about that. You may be avoiding contact sports in the developing brain. That makes a lot of sense to me. And then a great point about that not being the leading cause of traumatic brain injury, one of the causes. Right, but we do have to bring attention to the many other causes that bring about traumatic brain injury. So let's discuss more about this after we take our first break. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a comment or question for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of traumatic brain injury, diagnosis and treatments with our medical experts as Line 1 continues statewide.
From Alaska Public Media, you can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting February 28th, March 1st and 2nd in Juneau. More information at 800-478-1456. Or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by guests Dr. Katie Jakes, Doctor of Physical Therapy, exploring traumatic and acquired brain injury services for the state of Alaska, Dr. Adam Grove, Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine in private practice and founder of a nonprofit aimed at addressing gaps in brain injury services provided to rural areas of Alaska. And Dr. Dan Hartman, a primary care physician and service line medical director at South Central Foundation, who's involved in the development of services for traumatic and acquired brain injury. Are you aware of the signs and symptoms of a traumatic brain injury? Do you have a question about treatments for TBI? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So I think we started talking about the contact sports, and that kind of brings us into the use of helmets and the prevention, or I guess the decrease in risk of traumatic brain injury that it can provide, but not necessarily the elimination of risk. So what are some of the other specific recommendations that you can share about preventing brain injuries, both traumatic and acquired?
I think that the important thing to think about with prevention of brain injury is that it requires education, right? We've all been talking about this, the importance of educating people about, what causes a brain injury, right? So like in this state, and it's true nationwide, the vast majority of brain injuries occur from falls, and those peak in the young years and in the older years. And in the middle, there are accidents, assaults, those types of things. So if you really want to prevent the majority of brain injuries, almost half of them nationwide are due to falls, we work on fall prevention, right? So wearing those ice cleats, having adequate handrails and those types of things, and educating people about the importance of this, and especially in the young kids, to work on this too, to make sure the parents realize this. And so, and bicycle helmets and helmets for all different sports are all very different, right? So you shouldn't use a bicycle helmet if you're going to go downhill skiing. And it's important to know that helmets don't prevent the brain injury, like you said, but it does prevent skull fractures, right? But your brain is still sloshing around inside your skull. And so the helmets make a difference. But if you think about bicycles, the most important thing we can do to prevent injuries on bicycles is to actually have traffic control systems, separate bike lanes, and educate drivers about how to look for bicyclists. That's the most important thing. If you don't get hit, you don't need the helmet, right?
Oh, that is pretty important. Yes, better bike lanes. Yeah, my garage is full of helmets of all different types. I have to look to see, what is this helmet for? Dr. Hartman, maybe you could tell us about what exactly happens to our brain after that primary insult occurs.
Well, a lot. The brain is living tissue, of course. We tend to think of it, I think, as not maybe living tissue, mm-hmm. but just mm-hmm. as if we had a muscle injury, and we understand, I think, that the muscle needs to repair, that there will be inflammation and change in the muscle and a process of repair, and the muscle's inflamed and swells. The same thing happens with our brain, even if there's not a direct injury to the skull. The brain is essentially fluid in its physics. So if we have a difficult rapid decelerating injury, so for example, a motor vehicle accident where the belt holds us, the airbags are deployed, there's no major cabin intrusion, we don't actually have a direct blow to the head or a direct visible injury to our head, we can still have a mild traumatic brain injury or concussion from what's called a contra coup injury.
That's is that like whiplash?
Exactly. Oh, okay. Yeah, similar. Contra coup is French. It just means the brain basically moving inside the vault of the skull. And the inflammatory changes that happen with brain are normal. The repair process is normal. The issue is that brain tissue, if the cells die, they don't come back. And we're very lucky that we have many, 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 many brain cells, which is evolution. And we do quite well after several concussions, 2-4 concussions, for example, without deficits generally. As Adam was mentioning, the more brain injuries we sustain, the worse the issue can become. A single significant injury, the process of inflammation and repair around axons, or the main length of the neuron, is can be destructive. The repair process can be destructive, and it can be really important in moderate and severe brain injury to support oxygenation, blood pressure, respiratory status, so that that process of repair can be enhanced and that the damage is mitigated long term.
So you brought up some important points. One of them, you don't actually have to hit your head in order to suffer from a traumatic brain injury. So that could be new information from some, so that change of inertia, I guess, of the brain moving can lead to an issue. And then the other one, you talked about the death of the brain cells. So I'm thinking about stroke and how stroke then leads to traumatic brain injuries. You're losing oxygenation or blood flow to a portion of the brain. And then that, the loss of oxygen kills off those brain cells, I guess, in that area.
That's correct. A stroke could be, say, 15% of them would be hemorrhagic, which would be a bleeding stroke where downstream blood supply is lost and brain injury occurs. 85% would be ischemic or obstructive, where the blood flow is blocked. We also talk about anoxic brain injury, which would be, for example, a near drowning. So yes, you don't necessarily have to have a classic direct blow to the head, skull fracture, etc., to be at risk for having suffered a brain injury.
Well, let's go to our next caller. We have Kelly from Anchorage. Kelly, welcome to Line 1.
Hi.
Hello.
So I'm 37 right now, and when I was 8, my family was hit by a drunk driver, and I had a TBI. I woke up in the hospital, I was unconscious, and I woke up in the hospital with stitches on my head, and, they had to tell me what happened. But so this was 1994. I don't know if, TBI was a thing that people talked about back then. But I didn't start hearing that I had a TBI until the last 5 years. Now doctors are constantly saying it to me when they review my medical history. Oh, it looks like you had a TBI. And they kind of attribute so many of my problems to it. And there's never... I get tired of hearing, you have a TBI, and then there's not really a lot of solutions. I've had migraines since I was, the first one happened in, fifth grade, and it just very gradually got worse and more frequent. So I just deal with that, and I take medication and sometimes go to physical therapy. And I have ADHD, and, it runs in my family, but every doctor and behavioral health person, says it's probably the TBI, and it's that's it. It makes me feel sort of helpless. I don't know what to do with this information of being constantly being reminded by all medical professionals. I think this is what it is, and I have no solution.
Right, Kelly. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think you bring up a good point for us, is that there is not just one outcome from a TBI. There are so many ways that it can affect our lives. And so it could be that you have these symptoms from, or issues from the TBI, which brings up why there's a multidisciplinary approach needed to care for you. So let's go to Dr. Jakes and see what she can help with as far as guidance.
Hi, Kelly. I'm sorry to hear about your story, and just know that part of the work that we're doing with the Brain Injury Council right now is to help people that are in your situation that just don't know where to go based on what symptoms they have. At South Central Foundation, just recently received first-year grant fund from the Mental Health Trust Authority, and with that, we had the opportunity to go down to Colorado last week, actually, and to go see the Marcus Institute as well as Colorado Children's to explore their systems of care for brain injury. One thing that I liked about Marcus is that they call it brain health overall. I really like how that encompasses the whole person, a whole person approach to it, because it is there can be many different facets as to why you have certain symptoms and why it is a multidisciplinary approach, which can involve, I like to summarize therapy services kind of like the five senses. So occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech pathology, audiology, and optometry. There are different tests and measures that each of those different disciplines can do to see if it's part of your vestibular system, which is part of your inner ear, your eyes, and how your body reacts to space with balance. It could be visual as well. So maybe an eye exam that could be a little bit more in depth with like a neurooptometrist. Different symptoms like can also be behavioral as well, and mental health. So it is a multidisciplinary approach that would, that communication that is specialized towards the individual. That's where the state's looking to go and try to identify who those players are, how we can collaborate, how we can get people like yourself, Kelly, to the right team to be able to help manage some of these symptoms and return to a quality of life that is where you want it to be, at your goals and what you're passionate about.
On the website you mentioned earlier, is there a place where, you know, you said you put in your location, you can find people who are well-versed in traumatic brain injury? Is that somewhere where she could go to find a provider?
Not yet. That work is being done now where they're collecting the resources. I actually just did email them kind of to try to get an update. There was going to be a work group that was formulated a few months ago. There is a working one, but it's for through the University of Oregon, but the resource facilitator tool is not a live tool for Alaska yet.
Okay. Thank you. And
Our caller, I'll add this. This is Dan. Our caller, all sympathies to what you're going through, certainly. Our caller is pointing out an issue, which is we're one of the few states that does not have a structured TBI rehabilitation program, and that's a big part of what our work is right now in front of us that Dr. Grove, Katie, and I are talking about.
Thank you.
And this is Adam. If I could just put that in there, because Kelly, your experience is not uncommon, and the Concussion Legacy Foundation, with a grant from the Mental Health Trust Authority, just finished a survey of providers in Alaska who deal with brain injury, and they found that only 30% of those providers actually refer people for treatment. So this identifies the big gap in educating providers on what is available, right? And as Dan pointed out, what is available is maybe not what we would expect other places. So I think a lot of people sort of get referral fatigue. They're just like, there's nothing to do, which is not true, right? There are things that we can do. We do have resources in this state, but we need to work with providers so they know how to refer appropriately. So that was a big eye-opener for me, that we've only got 30% of these people that are seeing people with brain injury that actually do referrals, right? That's a big gap.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's take one more caller before we go to the break. And thank you, Kelly. I would like to welcome Jack from Craig to line one. Jack?
Yes, I'm here. I've had at least 4 skull fractures and a broken neck in the past. And I can't get onto a pressurized aircraft without having a seizure or a mini stroke. The last time it was a mini stroke, and I was unable to move the left side of my body for a couple of days, and then the doctors were amazed that I snapped out of that and was able to start moving my body again. And with no permanent brain damage, I've had at least 6 CAT scans. But I've been hit by drunk drivers twice, and I was in a bus accident that rolled over, and that was when I broke my neck. But we didn't know till later that I couldn't fly. The last time I flew was not good. And the weird thing is, after I woke up, I was no longer right-handed. I was left-handed. And I'm completely left-handed now, except I can sign my name with my right hand, but nothing else. So it's kind of strange. I'm wondering, though, have you ever heard of this before, that if I get into a pressurized aircraft, that it causes the mini stroke or the seizures? It's happened several times, so now I don't fly, but I can't go to Anchorage to the Alaska Native Medical Center for a checkup because there's no ferries from Southeast Alaska to Anchorage. And I haven't been referred thus far as to a specialist down south, which I would need a referral. I'm 60 years old, and because of this, I'm partially handicapped. So I'm kind of limited sometimes, and I have to have an escort. But I just don't understand what happened to me. Just I need to fly. I can't go the rest of my life without flying. But at the same time, I'm playing Russian roulette, I guess. So I've had one provider that understands that, and he's trying to help me deal with it. But this is only recently. We didn't know that I had a brain injury and a broken neck at the time in the bus. And I actually rescued everybody off the bus. But we didn't know I was hurt until the next day. And then I was diagnosed with a broken neck and was told there's nothing they could do about it. But I'm worried about that brain injury because it has affected my memory. I really have to think hard sometimes to come up. I can think of the word, but I can't say it. And
absolutely.
Getting a little bit worse and worse every day. Plus, I have neck pains and headaches constantly. I'm forever taking Tylenol, which is worrying me because I know it can really tax the liver. So I don't know what to do. So I was hoping you guys could help me out. I'm sure glad this program came on today.
Yes. Well, thank you, Jack, for sharing your story. Thank you for that. And let's go to Dr. Hartman and see what he can share with us.
Hi, Jack. Sorry for what's happened. Adam can jump in here, too, in a bit. But just as a quick explainer for what might be going on, when we get into an aircraft that's pressurized, it's flying up above 30,000 feet. It's pressurized to the range of 8,000 feet of elevation. And if we're going from sea level to 8,000 feet in a matter of minutes, there is a physiologic stress on our body. And that's why, by the by, we get fatigued when we fly. persons who have prior brain injury, either from stroke or any low oxygen state, when we have a physiologic stress, we can actually have a recurrence of the stroke symptoms in a small way. We call it a recrudescence. For example, if a person had left arm weakness with their stroke, if they have a physical stress, the blood flow to that brain, you can think of it as a watershed. The blood flow to that portion of brain that was injured is not as strong as it used to be in your normal state. So dehydration, illness, and hypoxia, if you're going to altitude in a pressurized aircraft, can cause a recrudescence of the prior symptoms of brain injury. For example, the prior injury of a brain injury or stroke. Also, if someone's vulnerable to seizures, the seizure threshold is lowered with hypoxia. It could be that supplemental oxygen in flight is helpful, and it could be that a medical order for that could be helpful, but I'm not in a position to comment on that, not knowing your situation, Jack. Now, with respect to the broader rehabilitative issues, Adam is an expert and Katie's an expert, and they can speak to that.
Okay. You know,
I think this
Dr.
is Adam.
Grove?
Yeah.
Let's get back to that. We have to take our last break, so we'll pick up with you when we come back from the break. There's so much information here to uncover. But let's take our last break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion about the future of brain-related treatments when we return. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Welcome back to Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are Dr. Adam Grove, Dr. Dan Hartman, and Dr. Katie Jakes, all medical providers who work together with the Brain Injury Association of Alaska to improve awareness in the availability of traumatic brain injury treatments and Alaskan communities. You can also join our conversation. Do you have a question about the signs and symptoms of a brain injury? Do you have experience with brain injury treatments that you would like to share? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752 in Anchorage at 907-550-8433 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So before the break, we were talking to Jack, who suffered from a TBI and can't fly due to the change of pressurization. Dr. Grove, you wanted to add something?
Yes. Yes, Jack, thanks for your story. It's pretty incredible that you live in Craig and you can't fly, so you're pretty much in Craig, right? So, and seizures, like Dan mentioned, are not uncommon after brain injury, and they can start up to a year after the brain injury, and sometimes they go away, sometimes they don't. But I also, you highlighted the fact that you had a neck fracture, too, and that's really important. It's for many, many people with traumatic brain injuries, it's really difficult to injure your head to the extent that you would sustain an injury to your brain without also injuring your neck. And there are some studies show up to 70% of symptoms like migraines and headaches of other sorts are actually due to the neck injury and not to the brain injury itself. So that would be another thing to think about when you're having some of these symptoms. It's not always the brain. The neck is a huge piece of this as well, and that's where PT can be very, very useful, and not just taking medications for the migraine, but trying to get to the root cause of those. So that might be part of the picture there, too. And just one last note, Jack, you mentioned that you had several CTs or CAT scans which were negative, and that's not uncommon. We haven't talked about that really, but imaging does not, most imaging does not show brain injury or brain damage at all, right? It just doesn't show up. You have to do very specific magnetic resonance imaging or MRI imaging in order to see that damage, and that probably, I mean, Dan can talk and Katie can talk to this more, but I don't think that's generally available. Most of that is probably just in Anchorage or the Anchorage area.
And Dr. Grove, this may not be, helpful specifically for Jack, but in your private practice, are you seeing these patients with brain injuries, and do you do any telemedicine throughout the state?
Yes, we do. Telemedicine is a great thing in this state, and unfortunately, with the end of the COVID emergency in May, being able to use telemedicine for people outside of the state, which we had brain injury specialists in Georgia that we would refer to, that's coming to an end, right? But within the state, my understanding is that telemedicine will continue, and that's a great tool to be able to get to people like Jack.
And then you're aware of the other, because there are, I guess, a lot of referrals that may be needed to other disciplines, and so having somebody that is able to treat brain injury and knows, hopefully, you have more knowledge of where to send people for physical therapy, occupational therapy, and other issues.
Yes, and I think, and certainly Dan and Katie are probably well aware of this, that if somebody needs speech, for example, and when we're talking about speech with brain injury, we're not just talking about your ability to say things, right, to be able to speak. It's about cognitive therapy as well. And so if you're in a village, those resources may not exist, right? And so the university speech-language pathology department is starting a program to get aids, speech-language pathology aids, from these communities to be trained so that then those services can be provided locally with supervision from somebody in Anchorage, say. And other states have been delivering, for example, some PT and OT and speech therapy via telemedicine. It can be done, right? I always say that brain injury treatment is not rocket science, right? It's basic stuff over and over and over again for the most part. So that's really important in this state, is to be able to push those resources out to those rural areas. And for that, we need people in those areas that are wanting to be trained. And it's much better to get somebody in your village to work with you than somebody in the hub or in Anchorage, because you need lots of therapy.
Absolutely. Having treatment where you are. Let's go to our next caller. We have Wes from Homer. Welcome to Line 1, Wes.
Oh, thank you. And thank you very much for this program. It's been quite helpful.
Oh, thank you for listening.
You're quite welcome.
What would you like to share with us?
Well, I got this brain injury several years ago. And, well, the doctors down here, they couldn't quite figure out what. And so I went to a neurological facility in Lake Oswego, Oregon. And they were quite helpful and gave me exercises to do. And then, of course, the COVID thing hit and couldn't get anything done. But my main issue is, well, besides constant headaches and vision problems, even changing my glasses prescription, I have difficulty doing computer or even texting on a little phone thing. And I was wondering if there's a facility that I could go to where somebody could do the computer stuff for me. I could write it down and give them a sheet, and then they Google or whatever they do.
Oh, right. Wes, that's a really great question. So may I ask around what your age is?
Well, I'm a bit older. I'm 68, but I still get around okay. And I do perfectly fine out there in nature, out in the woods. It's just like, just natural. But even reading a newspaper, I find I can only read maybe a page at a time now. I've got to take a break. The computer is.
Yes. Okay.
It's totally impossible.
That's difficult. Well, I'm not familiar with Homer. I know here there are senior sitters that can do those things for you and help you with computers and the reading and work with you for that. So I'm not sure about Homer. We'd have to check. Dr. Grove, do you have something to add to that?
Yes, a couple of things, Wes, and it's radio, so you can't see that I was smiling when you said you were older, right? So we're not that different in age. And I've had some similar experiences. So the first thing I would say is that they're called ADRCs, Aging Disability Resource Centers, and they're scattered throughout the state. I do believe there's one down in if it's not in Homer, it's down in the Kenai somewhere. And those are the places you can call and say, I need help with this type of thing, filling out paperwork and that kind of thing. But I would say that's an accommodation, and accommodations are fine. But if treatment can be, if we could make your eyes work better, and it's not your eyes, it's your brain. It's the way your brain is processing the information coming through your eyes. And most eye doctors, they're specialists in the eyeball, right? And they stop at the eyeball. They don't go back into how your brain is processing that. So there are specialists who do that, and they can range from sort of neurologic ophthalmologists, there's a few around, or vision specialists or vision therapy specialists. And I would recommend you see one of those folks. And the person I usually refer to is Dr. Keene in Eagle River. He's been around forever, very nice guy. And a lot of the solutions that he implements for people are very simple. They can put prisms in your glasses. They can give you tinted lenses. And I myself suffer from a number of vision changes since my brain injury. And I had to be very careful about my glasses and the way I use the screen. So there's help out there, Wes. So contact the ADRC and look for somebody to help with vision.
Thank you so much, Dr. Roof. So helpful. And sorry that we didn't get to all of these phone calls, but I will respond to the emails. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Dan Hartman, Dr. Katie Jakes, and Dr. Adam Grove for being with us today. Thanks to our engineers, Chris Hyde and Cleo La Liberté. And thanks to our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website, alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.